It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI. This hour, is privacy dead?
There is an argument to be made that the powers of Big Brother have increased enormously.
Edward Snowden is back in the news, and his revelations make you wonder who's watching you. Today, what the reports of government surveillance mean for ordinary citizens, and how careful are you about what you post online?
Rules switch with respect to Facebook, and people don't know how what they post might actually come back to haunt them.
Negotiating the complexities of online privacy, plus the new story of the Big Bang. First, the news. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, is privacy dead?
Who I am really doesn't matter at all. If I'm the worst person in the world, you can hate me and move on. What really matters here are the issues. What really matters here is the kind of government we want, the kind of internet we want, the kind of relationship between people and societies.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden made a surprise appearance at a TED conference this past week, speaking from an undisclosed location through a remote-controlled video chatbot. Snowden assured the audience there will be more revelations of government secrets in the months ahead, and he said it's critical we understand the full scope of government surveillance.
Democracy may die behind closed doors, but we as individuals are born behind those same closed doors. And we don't have to give up our privacy to have good government. We don't have to give up our liberty to have security.
Snowden is in Russia on temporary asylum from the U.S., but he's made a couple of virtual appearances recently. Ben Weisner's been following all the twists and turns of this story. When he's not directing the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, he doubles as Snowden's legal advisor. We reached him at his office in New York. Ben, you were moderating Edward Snowden's first public conversation at South by Southwest. What was the atmosphere in the room like when he was talking?
It was pretty remarkable. There were several thousand people in the room, and they, in fact, had two spillover rooms to accommodate those who couldn't fit in that room, and it was being live-streamed. I think that people were moved to actually see him there. You know, I think that people were quite interested to hear him speaking to an audience of his peers.
Yeah. There's something almost symbolically kind of sexy about what he did, at least for a tech audience, I would think. You know, here's one of the most hunted guys in the world who lives surrounded by layers and layers of encryption. And yet, look, the internet has made him free.
Yes, I think, you know, in particular, the robot that he rolled out in at TED is quite a disruptive technology. You know, it allows him to stand and have a one-on-one conversation with a camera at eye level, looking eye to eye with really anyone in the world, and to operate that from where he is. And I agree, there's something very, very, very powerful about that. You know, he shared the TED stage almost literally with Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the World Wide Web, the inventor of it. Here was the father, in a sense, talking to the son on a stage, and I think that it had a strong emotional impact for people.
So does this bother you at all? I mean, I know you're Snowden's legal advisor, but you know, you can't get around the fact that he broke the law. He released classified documents. He's wanted by the U.S. government, and yet now he's kind of being treated as a tech folk hero.
You know, to me, and I say this unabashedly, what he did should be admired. He, acting through journalists, gave the public information that the public had a right to know and had a need to know.
Putting aside the question of his guilt, what do Edward Snowden's disclosures tell us about the state of privacy in the U.S. today?
Well, I think actually privacy might be too small a word for what these disclosures tell us, because the debate that has begun, that should have happened before these mass surveillance techniques were deployed and not after, is about mass surveillance and free societies. It is dangerous for one branch of government, and really one part of one branch of government, to have full information about the communications, contacts, associations of not just everyone in the country, but also the other branches of government, every member of Congress, every federal judge. I worry very much that if we give, right now it's the NSA, But this information will not be limited to the NSA. It will be the DEA. It will be the FBI. It will be your local police before long who will have access to these mass databases of information.
Right. This is the argument that it's not Big Brother we should be worrying about. It's little brother?
Well, it's both. It is both. But I think that there has been a lot of concern across the country about what will happen when our local police are able to fly drones over our cities. You know, to me, the question of mass surveillance of our communications records is not so different. And in fact, it's not just communications records. We learned through some of these disclosures that the GCHQ, which is the British equivalent of NSA, is stealing webcam streams from Yahoo. So people who are recording themselves, maybe even in their bedrooms, using their webcams, this information is ending up in these kinds of databases.
Yeah. So presumably this is what Snowden is trying to wake up the tech community to. So at the moment, tech communities spend a lot of money trying to encrypt and secure our networks against, you know, foreign hackers and cyber criminals. Are they now going to try to design security and encryption to keep the U.S. government out?
Well, it's not really different. It's the same security that you need to use to protect data from an entity like the NSA and to protect it from China or from hackers. I think that they were operating under what technologists would call an outdated threat model. And when they learned what the NSA was doing that was actually weakening their own defenses, already in the last 9 months, there have been tremendous adaptations by these tech companies to encrypt more data. Now, a company like Google is never going to fully encrypt end-to-end user data because Google is an advertising company. Google needs to its computers to be able to read our content in order to decide what advertisements to serve to us. But Google can do a lot more to ensure that the data is encrypted at other transit points.
So we're living in a world in which encryption is going to be everything, at least as a method of combating online surveillance. The problem, it seems to me, is that encryption tools are often only available to the people who have the means and, you know, the technological savvy to know how to use them. I mean, even Glenn Greenwald famously almost lost his scoop because he couldn't install encryption software on his computer before he connected with Snowden. And I guess I wonder, is online privacy, true online privacy, going to become a luxury?
I think we need to focus not so much on true privacy, but on bigger words like freedom. You know, it's not just a question of being able to live individual lives unobserved. Fundamentally, it's a question of how much power we want government and other large institutions to have vis-a-vis the people. Again, I think at an individual level, much of this is a losing proposition. But what we're really having a conversation about is, do we want our government to be able to collect and store all the information about all of our lives without good reason? Should they, just as a matter of course, be able to collect and store this? Now, they say nothing important is happening when they collect it and store it, that it's only important when they search it, that it doesn't matter what is sitting in their massive data warehouses, that it only becomes a legal concern when they look through it. I don't think that's true, but I mainly don't think that's true because I don't have any faith in their assurances that the rules that govern their access to that data today are going to be the rules that govern their access to it tomorrow. I think it's inevitable, and it's always happened in history, that information that's collected for one purpose will be used for many, many, many other purposes. I think now is the time that we need to start getting this right before it's too late.
You know, listening to you, I realize that I walk around largely unconscious and unaware of most of this stuff. It doesn't occur to me that I would be watched in some way or another. Do you feel watched?
Watching is a relative term. If you knew when you walked through a park that there was a surveillance camera on every other tree, even if you didn't think that there was somebody sitting in a room watching the screen at all times, it would probably constrain your behavior. You would think about it before you held your lover's hand or exchanged a kiss. One of the concerns about a society in which everything is tracked and recorded is that even if no one is watching it right now, it's going to change the way we experience being a person in a free society. Again, I think drones are a powerful illustration of that. I think we all know that if drones were flying over our cities and towns and recording all public movements, we would be conscious of that kind of eye in the sky. We're much less conscious of it when it's in our pocket than when it's overhead. But I think that we do need to wake up to this, you know, before we wake up in a very different kind of society that we hadn't thought enough about.
Music. Ben Wisner directs the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, and he's Edward Snowden's legal advisor. We're talking about how privacy is under siege. And, you know, we all tend to think that we have a right to a certain amount of privacy in our lives. But most of the time when we talk about it, it's because we've lost it. So what is privacy? Garrett Kaiser's a writer and contributing editor of Harper's Magazine. He's also the author of a book called Privacy. Kaiser tells Steve Paulson how he would define it.
That is a complicated question, and the more I studied it, the more I realized that it was. I might call it a claim to one's existence over and against the overweening agendas of other existences. The right to have one's body, one's living space, one's own relationships and intimacies undisturbed, which sounds abstract, as many things that people say about privacy will, but in practice and experience usually becomes something very concrete and even associated with objects.
It sounds like you're suggesting then that it's more than just being let alone, sort of not being bothered. You want to expand the notion of privacy because there are various ways that our space, our life, might be invaded, infringed upon in ways that we don't even know about.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, a consideration of privacy leads us to a consideration of who we are as human beings and what we have a right to demand for ourselves and what we have an obligation to extend to others. As I was starting to say about the concreteness of privacy, one discovers that in very particular ways in a situation like a shared dorm space or a shared barrack space where suddenly there are three of you in one room. And this is my bed, and this is my girlfriend on the phone, so maybe you're going to go someplace else instead of listening in.
Hmm. Now, you offer another definition of privacy in your book as a creaturely resistance to being used against one's will.
Yes.
Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from my thinking about privacy and realizing that violations of privacy, willful violations of other people's privacy, often comes, in my view, from looking at those people, viewing those people not as individuals equal to oneself and like oneself, but rather as objects or conveniences or things to be used either for one's entertainment or one's amusement or to gain information. And so I think that the violation of privacy and the exploitation of other people are united or function together, but I also think that exploited people usually have less privacy.
Hmm. Now, privacy is never actually mentioned in the United States Constitution, is it?
That's right, and many people are surprised to discover that. There is no word privacy in the United States Constitution. There are amendments like the Fourth against unreasonable searches and seizures and the Fifth against self-incrimination, from which a right of privacy has been derived by subsequent jurists. But there's no mention of the word privacy in the Constitution. I don't find that troubling. I tend to find it beautiful. I don't know if I find this beautiful, but there's no mention of gender equality or the illegality of slavery in the Constitution either, at least in the original document. But these things grew out of thinking about the Constitution. They evolved from it. The seed was there, I would say, and it came to flower. I think to say that privacy is a lesser right because it's not in the Constitution is like saying that a couple's child either does not exist or is not their child because he wasn't present at their wedding.
And you make the case that liberty and justice for all are necessary qualities for privacy.
Well, I certainly feel that they are. One needs liberty in the sense of personal choice and volition and self-determination for privacy to have much meaning. If you don't have freedom of choice, then privacy is not privacy any more than lovemaking in the presence of force is anything other than rape, or work in the presence of force is anything other than slavery. Privacy without liberty is just isolation and loneliness, and likewise, without justice, privacy is just a cloak for one's privilege or a cloak for one's misery. There's a flip side to that, though. which is that liberty without a respect for individual privacy just becomes a kind of anarchic dog-eat-dog pursuit of the will to power. And justice, and historically we've seen that, without a regard for privacy, tends to move the more zealous in the direction of totalitarianism. In my book, I say that privacy is the unspoken word in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Now, my sense is that our understanding of privacy has changed quite a bit since 9/11. In a very concrete way, the Patriot Act of 2001 seemed to put some limits on privacy. What has changed?
Well, in my view, the change may have occurred before the USA Patriot Act rather than after it. One historian says something like 40 years of privacy legislation were rolled back by it. I think the change came about partly through fear, not just a legitimate fear of terrorists, but a fear of, on the part of our legislatures, of seeming to be less than tough on terror. I mean, the Patriot Act is a massive document, and it was put through Congress at a rate that argues strongly against the likelihood that anyone read it all that carefully. But we began to say or to think that in view of 9/11, that privacy was a luxury.
Right. I mean, the assumption is that there are bad people out there wanting to do harm to us, and we need some surveillance apparatus to keep tabs on them, to find them.
Well, I think it would be frivolous for me to argue that there aren't bad people out there and that we don't need perhaps stronger surveillance to catch them. But I'm always dubious whenever someone takes a right or a good, and to call that a luxury. I want to know who's calling it a luxury, whether they're giving up their own luxury, and what agenda lies behind their statement. In the case of privacy and terrorism, I think two points need to be made. First of all, terrorism is rightly seen as an attack on our way of life. But what I fail to see is how we can defend ourselves against that attack by joining with it in destroying our way of life, including our constitutional liberties. And second of all, I fail to see how a cult of compliance makes us better equipped to defend ourselves against terrorists. In other words, I'm willing to grant that there's a wolf at the door. I'm less willing to grant that turning a population into sheep will provide the best defense against the wolf. I would cite two what I see as related incidents, post-9/11 incidents, and one was the taking of Flight 93, where the passengers overpowered the terrorists. Mm-hmm. And then what would seem to some as an entirely different kind of act, where passengers refused to go into naked screening machines, virtual strip search machines, and you had a man named John Tyner saying, before a pat-down, you touch my junk and I'll have you arrested. And people saw that as an outrageous thing to do because of all of the terror threats. I would say that Mr. Tyner's action and the actions of the passengers on 93 were related. They both grew out of what I see as a very elemental right that we have, even an instinct we have, to being tampered with. Both were saying, Mr. Tyner and the passengers were saying, you are not going to do this to us. And if we lose the ability to say that, God help us in any time, let alone in an age of terror. We might as well sue for terms now.
Garrett Kaiser's a writer and contributing editor of Harper's Magazine and author of a book called Privacy. Coming up, the line between public and private life is blurring in the age of social media, and those amusing online posts could come back to haunt you. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. In this hour, we're asking, is privacy dead? We've been talking about the technologies that could be used to monitor your life and your movements, but what does it actually feel like to be watched? For the first 16 years of her life, Marina Lutz was tracked by her father. He captured every piece of her life, from the mundane to the intimate, on reel-to-reel audio tapes and Super 8 films. She rediscovered the footage when she was an adult, and she's assembled it into her award-winning documentary, The Marina Experiment.
There's a series of photographs that he took of me potty training. And some people might look at these pictures taken out of context and just say, oh, those are pictures of a child potty training.
Well, first, Marina, I think you should go pee-pee.
All right.
All right? I want to take a picture. Smile for me now. Atta girl. Oh, that's beautiful.
But for me, and the reason I use them in the film was because in that instance, and in quite a few others, there was repetitive photographing on his part of women's behinds. And when I looked at it, it was like I could feel him lingering on me longer than need be. That's what the pictures felt like. It was the male gaze that I felt from him when I saw the pictures.
What are you doing, Marina? Marina? Marina?
The memories that I had were and are continue to be visceral. So just hearing his voice and also hearing him constantly bullying me into doing things that I didn't want to do and hearing myself as this tiny little girl sort of weeping and not wanting to do things.
I don't want to sing.
In probably 2003, I started really going through the archive again and decided that in order to bring some of the material into my therapy, I needed to try to maybe use editing to put together little snippets that I could bring in and show my therapist so that she could understand how this stuff made me feel. I refer to everything in the archive as evidence because that's what it feels like to me. It's not documentation of a happy childhood. There's not one picture of my parents hugging me. There's not a film of them hugging me. There's no evidence of them ever holding me or loving me or caring about me. The pictures that are taken of me, I always am posed or looking extremely unhappy. So I guess it's evidence of a very sad childhood. I don't like the word victim, and I say that in one of the pieces that I wrote, that I prefer to think of myself as an opponent. Although I don't know what other word to use, I guess I feel like a victim now in that I'm constantly coming up against the same challenges that I can't get past. I mean, really, all I really want, and I think it's what everybody wants in life, is to be loved. But I don't know how to let that love in, because my experience with that has been so negative that that it doesn't feel good when somebody actually cares about me. It feels terrifying.
That was Marina Lutz on her award-winning documentary, The Marina Experiment. You'll find an extended version of this story on our website at ttbook.org. We've all heard the cautionary tales about ill-advised Facebook posts. That picture of you at a party on your third beer, at a political rally, or wearing last year's very tasteless Halloween costume. You think you're sharing with friends. But what you post online can be found by employers, schools, lawyers, and the results can be disastrous. People have lost jobs and even custody of children thanks to injudicious posts. Laurie Andrews is the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, social networks, and the death of privacy. She describes Facebook as Facebook Nation.
Well, it actually has a population that would make it the third largest nation in the world after China and India. And yet, if you think about it, what are its rules? It has an economy. It actually has Facebook money. It has citizens. It has relationships with other nations. And yet, instead of having a constitution, it has rules that switch at a moment's notice. So Facebook used to promise that everything you did would be private. And then in 2009, it decided to make your friends public. And that had repercussions around the world. There were U.S. critics of Tehran who had Facebook pages where they had friended friends and relatives in Iran. And when their friends' pictures and names became public, those friends were picked up in Iran by the police, beat up, and so forth. So rules switch with respect to Facebook, and people don't know how what they post might actually come back to haunt them.
So are you saying that thinking of Facebook as a nation and realizing that we all, to a greater or lesser extent, have become citizens of this Facebook nation is a way of beginning to think more critically of the structures and rules or lack of rules that govern our behavior in Facebook Nation?
There are really important rules that you'd have in any other setting. And so if you think of my offline self as being regulated by national laws, why not have regulations for my online self? So certain protections that I have. Everybody's familiar with how health information is protected when it's in the hands of doctors or in the hands of hospitals. They can't just disclose and so forth. But if I say on Facebook, even on my private page of Facebook, that I'm thinking of getting pregnant, or if I like the American Cancer Society, an employer who would otherwise hire me might not, based on the idea that I could charge a lot to their health insurance. So things that are forbidden, asking a potential employee if she's planning to get pregnant or if cancer runs in her family, are not protected online. So thinking about Facebook as a nation is a way to start people thinking and demanding their rights online.
So basically you're saying that unlike Las Vegas, what happens in Facebook doesn't stay in Facebook.
Absolutely not. And so 75% of employers now require their human resource people to check your online presence before offering you a job. And 24% of employers or more say that they've turned down people for having a drink in their hand on their Facebook photo, even an innocent wine glass at a wedding for someone who is over 21. I think of poor Ashley Payne. She was a high school teacher, 24 years old, on summer vacation. She went to Ireland. She posted, as many young people do on Facebook, 700 photos of her vacation. In 10 of them, she had wine or beer in her hand, including on the tour of the Guinness factory. And they're very, very innocent photos. She's not drunk at all. She's toasting someone. She's on this tour. Lost her job as a result of it, even though as a high school teacher, she hadn't friended any students or any parents of students where they might have claimed she was setting a bad example. So here is something that perfectly legal behavior gets her into trouble.
So that just seems wrong. Did that case or do cases like it go to courts? What have the courts decided?
Courts have not caught up with social networks. And so courts have said you have no right to privacy in anything you post. In fact, a New York judge said even your emails should be thought of like a postcard, that you have no privacy rights over them. That could be made public. Now, think about that for a moment. I'm a lawyer. I might email clients. I certainly don't want that public. I think there's an attorney-client privilege I don't want to lose. And I think we should equally be thought to have a reasonable expectation of privacy in what we do on the websites. Now we're disclosing there even more private information than we'd ever before talked about to third parties. People talk about on a typical Facebook page their political preferences, their sexual preferences. In fact, Richard Power, a security analyst, said, think about if the government tried to get that sort of very, very intimate information, everything you've ever bought, everything you believe in. He said it would take money, it would take lawyers, it might even take guns. but we freely give it. And this is fascinating. 93% of the time when the government asks Google for our private information, Google turns it over.
On the other hand, isn't this what privacy settings are for? I mean, can't people just adjust their privacy settings and keep all that stuff private?
On social networks like Facebook, you didn't used to have privacy settings. It was only when they started to get Google Envy and Google Plus came out with abilities to restrict who you showed things through that Facebook put privacy settings in. But now employers in Maryland and Montana have gotten sneaky, and they've started asking people for their passwords to Facebook. I was recently at a signing ceremony with Governor Pat Quinn in Illinois. He asked me to speak there because Illinois and Maryland have now passed laws saying it is illegal for your employer to ask for your social network password.
Wow. What happens if an employee in one of those states refuses, says, no, my social network is private, you can't see it?
Are you really going to get the job then? The idea is you're hiding something. See, I'm less worried about that almost than coercion. How can I say no, really, if I know there are 50 people in competition for the job in a tough market? There's another whole layer to this. Beyond what we post, data aggregators collect information about what we've done on the web, not just what we've posted on social networks, but what we've searched for in internet searches, what websites we've been to, how much time we spent on the page. And there are a variety of companies. There's one called Axiom that for 96% of Americans has 1,500 pieces of information, including what pharmaceuticals you take and so forth.
Wait. You mean for you and for me, this company probably has 1,500 pieces of information about each of us?
Yes. And so how it gets it is you visit a website and that website puts web beacons, cookies, other sort of tracking mechanisms that then follow you all over the web. It is astonishing because, I mean, we might think, okay, I can be careful. I don't need to put up those drunken hot tub photos. I don't need to like strange biker gangs. You know, I can clean up my own Facebook page in a way.
Be careful not to diss my employer on my Facebook page.
Yeah. But what about the fact that in addition to writing nonfiction about social networks, I write mystery books? So my Google searches, I actually invented a date rape drug for one book and I blew up the White House in another one. Well, if that is readily available to people, as it is through these cookies, whole criminal cases have been based on Google searches that people have done.
You're kidding. For example?
Say my sister. I love my sister, but she disappears. Maybe she's gone off, you know, to start a new life. But if I've looked at, like, the depth of a nearby lake, that's the sort of thing that they consider problematic. Or if I've done searches for different types of weapons, which I have for my mysteries. I love writing books. I love dictionary.com. It puts 233 tracking mechanisms on my computer.
Just from the words you've looked up in the dictionary?
From before even that, just going to the website. And so websites work like that. I mean, sometimes it's to your advantage. So Amazon.com will have a tracking mechanism that will remember your credit card if you want, or remember that you like mysteries or that you love my recent book, and that sort of thing. And so to your advantage. But other sites just go on and aggregate based on the words that you've used in an email, based on the words that you've used in a web search. So say I write to my sister, who I've already told you I adore, and I say, I'm thinking of getting a divorce through my Gmail account. That's actually scanned, and ads are based on that, and that information is collected as a data point about me. Or if I go on a website and look up old guitars, so I've done those two things. Now I go on a credit card site. I will be offered a less good credit card, if I'm offered any credit card at all, based on the fact that people who are likely to get a divorce are less likely to pay off their credit card bills, and people who are in garage rock bands don't have that much money.
How have people's social network posts entered the courtroom? I mean, to what extent are posts on Facebook actually used in trials as evidence?
It's now an astonishingly high percentage of family law cases. And I particularly see it used against women. If you've posted a sexy picture, you could lose custody of your child in a case. Or for men, if they've ever on Match.com said They don't have children in any setting. When they actually do, they could lose custody based on that. You know, that's just one example where it's really come up in a very big way. But a woman lost custody of her young teen daughter to the dad because of something sexy the teen daughter had posted. Now, you know, she was just as likely to have posted it if she'd been in the dad's house. Judges are taking what's happening on social networks at a sort of face value that I don't think they should.
You've come up with at least one step toward a solution, something you call the social network constitution. Could you just quickly give us an overview of what the social network constitution is?
Sure. Well, it's the 225th anniversary of the U.S. Constitution, and I've suggested we need a social network constitution to make sure our online rights are in line with our offline rights. And one thing that interests me is that, surprisingly, younger people actually do care about privacy. The Pew polls, their Center for Internet and Society, has found that people 18 to 30 actually have higher privacy concerns, 71% for the younger groups, as opposed to 56% overall. So as opposed to privacy being dead, as some of the social network founders have said, I think it is very much alive, and now we just have to make sure that we protect it.
Laurie Andrews is the author of I Know Who You Are and I Saw What You Did, Social Networks and the Death of Privacy. Still using social media? You can join the discussion on our Facebook page. When we come back, the big news this week in physics and a dangerous idea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
To the Best of Our Knowledge proudly presents
Dangerous Ideas.
Bradley Garrett, urban explorer.
When we're children, I think that we feel more free to engage with places on very personal terms. So, you know, you go into places and you build forts and you make home and you don't worry so much about what the rules are or where you are or are not supposed to be. And, you know, you get to a certain age and this social conditioning sets in where people, you know, tell you what the rules are and you start conforming to the rules. And I think that we lose something really vital, that ability to be curious and to be playful and to try things out. The idea behind urban exploration is about revealing the hidden in the world. So it's about going into places that are essentially off limits. And many of these places, because they're off limits, have been relatively forgotten. Abandoned buildings, I guess, are the archetypal example. There are vacant tunnel systems, and indeed tunnel systems which are in use, like metro tunnels or electricity tunnels. And then, of course, construction sites, places that are being built. In the United Kingdom, where I am, trespass is not a criminal offense. It's a civil offense. And that goes back to old laws about rambling in the English countryside. I guess they didn't really anticipate that people were going to be trespassing in construction sites or in subterranean tunnels. In the United States, we take a little bit more risk, but there is a very large community of urban explorers in New York, Minneapolis, and various other places, despite those risks. And we all know that at any point, a sewer could fill up and we could drown, that someone could lose their grip and fall from a crane. That's a possibility. There are vast industrial ruins across the American Midwest and also across Europe. And, you know, going into these places, the scale is almost inhuman. When you go into them and you imagine the place thriving with thousands of workers and the assembly lines producing and the trucks moving things in and out, and yet you walk in and all you hear is the wind and the rain dripping through the ceiling, and you can sit down and sort of be absorbed in the history of these places. I think that's certainly part of the allure. I think that there certainly is something political about countering security measures, about pointing out that security is flawed, in sort of pushing back on this notion that everything we do in life needs to be regulated and controlled and authorized. You know, sometimes there needs to be a little bit of room for spontaneity and for chaos.
Bradley Garrett is a cultural geographer at the University of Oxford in England. He's the author of Explore Everything: Place Hacking the City. You can hear more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. Cosmology is on our minds this week with a remarkable new discovery confirming the Big Bang and the inflationary theory of the universe. Why does it matter? Because the creation stories we tell, like the Big Bang, fundamentally shape our sense of ourselves. Steve Paulson talks about this with Adam Frank. He's an astrophysicist who writes for NPR's science blog, 13.7, and he's the author of the book About Time: Cosmology and Culture at the Twilight of the Big Bang.
You start off your book by saying the Big Bang is all but dead, which I think will surprise a lot of people who consider this the reigning explanation for the origins of the universe. So why do you say the Big Bang is dead?
Well, I think the key point is your use of the word origins. The Big Bang is a wonderful explanation for what happened after the origin. So what the Big Bang essentially does is it presents you with a roadmap for the evolution of the universe starting at, you know, this is perhaps a little bit debatable, but, you know, certainly after about a millionth of a second after the moment of creation, the Big Bang does an exquisite job and an exquisitely well-documented job in terms of the relationship to data at explaining how atoms and molecules formed, how those turned into clumps of gas that became galaxies, et cetera, leading to what we see today.
So you're saying the science goes back to about a millionth of a second after the actual creation, but the creation itself is beyond the science that at least that we have today.
Well, what's happened is, you know, we've been pushing further and further back. The more we learn about the internal constitution of matter, this is what we do in those giant particle accelerators like the Large Hadron Collider in Europe. But the actual moment itself, that has always remained a fundamental mystery shrouded in what we call a singularity.
So it sounds like you're saying it's not that the Big Bang is wrong. It's just that it's incomplete and it has nothing to say about the actual absolute beginning.
Exactly. And so in order to go further, to go back to the beginning or to understand what happened before the Big Bang, the all-important question of was there a beginning at all, physicists have had to push against the governing equations as they understand them, the equations of general relativity, which is Einstein's theory for gravity, and the theories of quantum physics, which describe matter at its smallest domains. And basically, those equations do not talk to each other. General relativity is not a quantum theory. And so people have been searching for theories of quantum gravity. And because of that, it's led them into a complete wild west of theorizing that in many cases make the Big Bang, the idea of an origin itself, irrelevant, that you don't need a Big Bang at all. There's a number of ideas, things like the multiverse or string theory or even wilder ideas that sort of push against the idea of there being a beginning.
Of course, the whole idea of the Big Bang, at least the way I had always heard about it, was that there was nothing before the Big Bang.
Exactly.
This was the moment that space and time started, and before that, there was nothing.
Right.
And you're saying that there are a lot of cosmologists now saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there was something before. In fact, maybe there are all these other universes out there, and the Big Bang popped out of something else.
Right. This idea of does the universe have a beginning? Has the universe always existed? Will it always exist? Has been around since the age of myth, essentially. And so with the Big Bang, we just oscillated over to one version of an answer to that, that the universe just started and there was nothing before, which, you know, people sort of said, oh, look, this just sounds like Genesis. And now what we're finding as we push harder against the science is perhaps we should be moving back to the other pole in the answer to that question, which is that the universe always did exist. But of course, with science, you can't just sort of say that. You have to sort of understand, you have to build the mathematical framework to embrace the data. And through that, people now are coming to these what may be very interesting and sometimes crazy sounding ideas, like there's infinite numbers of universes that are all parallel to each other, or that there's more dimensions than we can possibly see. The universe may have, you know, 10 spatial dimensions rather than the three that we just exist with, that we're used to seeing.
So why does this matter? I mean, to other than astrophysicists who obsess over these things, for just ordinary people, does it matter whether the science has some explanation about how everything started?
Well, the remarkable answer to that question is yes, it matters profoundly. It's really about time. It's about how we experience time, how we organize time, how we shape our days through time. Think about when the clock was first introduced into Europe around the 1300s. If you asked somebody in, say, you know, 500 AD, what time is it? They sort of tell you, well, lunch. You know, that was about as good as it got. There were no clocks. Clocks did not appear until 1300. And when they did, they swept through Europe. Within 100 years, every town in Europe has a clock in it.
So the clock basically meant that everyone could agree on the same time, whereas before, that possibility didn't exist.
Exactly. And people didn't need it, essentially, right? The culture had not evolved to the point that it was necessary for everybody to have that kind of accuracy. You moved by the, you know, the movement of the sun. And, you know, that sort of sets the boundary conditions or initial conditions for human life, right? The sun comes up, the sun goes down. But needing a much more accurate and universally agreed upon division of the day was not something that occurred until the beginning of modern Europe, as trade and commerce really began to take off in the 13 and 1400s. That was when culture needed a time that was more exact.
Didn't some of the first clocks actually come out of the early European monasteries?
Yes. The monasteries were really the one place in Europe, in the European culture after the fall of Rome in the Western Empire, that some kind of time discipline, more rigorous time discipline, was needed.
Which is fascinating when you think about it, because you'd think the monasteries would be, I don't know, maybe more interested in sacred time, God's time, rather than the time of how to get through the day.
Well, in the beginning, it was God's time. You know, the reason why they were interested in or they needed those divisions was because to keep the hours, the canonical hours, which were essentially the different types of prayer that they had to, you know, that they moved through the day. But then what happened is once this clock, once the clocks made it out into the broader culture, you very quickly see the clock being used as a metaphor for the universe, right? It's only about 100 years after the introduction of clocks that you start hearing the clockwork universe.
Wait, being, wasn't that Isaac Newton's big idea?
Well, it was Nicolas Orsme who first – that term actually got out into the culture. And then, yes, Newton's version, Newton's radical invention in time, right, his reimagining of time was to imagine that time was God's clock. And that's what he used to build his laws of physics. And they became the basis for the Industrial Revolution's machines.
And, of course, at a certain point, you didn't just have clocks. You had the breakdown of the day into hours and minutes. When was the hour invented?
Well, the hours actually, there was this big debate. Once clocks became part of European culture, in the beginning it was bells. They were just tolling units, essentially. By 1400, you saw that sort of being locked in. And then that abstraction, and when the bell strikes one, that's when you go back to work, right? When the bell strikes five, that's when you're allowed to leave work. Minutes, however, minutes do not appear until the end of the 1700s. Why? Well, in some sense, we didn't need them, right? You know, nobody experienced a minute beforehand because the culture didn't need it. But once you started having machines based on Newtonian physics that moved very rapidly, right? You had the first industrial machines spinning, you know, 1,000 times a second or hundreds of times a second, being able to stamp out small pieces of metal, maybe 50 or 60 of those in an hour or so or even less. Suddenly, minutes began to matter. So there's this very tight coupling between the ability to mark minutes with your clock and your use for them.
It's fascinating to think about how this actually affects daily life and how we experience time. Because, I mean, it's so hard to sort of imagine a situation that's different than our own, a culture right. that's different. And, you know, I'm sort of trying to think, you know, so how much was life different in the 1300s or the 1400s, which had invented this idea of the 24-hour day, as opposed to the 1700s, which then had broken the day down into minutes? I mean, were these radically different experiences of time?
Oh, absolutely. I think people were essentially living in a different world than a truly a different world. And if you want a sort of modern equivalent of this, I mean, some people will be able to understand this. Cell phones have really radically changed the way we just sort of move through the day, right? I watch my students, the bell rings, they all get up, they walk outside to the quad, and instantly the cell phone is out and they're talking to each other like, hey, man, what are you doing? I don't know. What are you doing? Right? This we can't take a walk by ourselves without sort of pulling out that cell phone or, you know, checking our email. This is the way we, you know, through our technology, the way we experience time and move through the day. Imagine if you were going to go from point A to point B, there were no trains, you probably didn't own a horse, you were going to have to walk. And it was going to take perhaps 4 or 5 hours to walk from one town to the next.
So is there a connection then between this speeded up time that we experience in our daily lives? I mean, the fact that we have all these electronic gadgets now and we're instantly in touch with the whole world around us and this debate about the Big Bang and all these great cosmological questions?
Oh, I think there's a very deep connection in them. Let's just go back a little bit to sort of think about how we got to the Big Bang. There was another transition around the turn of the last century, you know, the 1900s, that was just as important for the development of time and cosmology. And that was, on one hand, Einstein, and on the other hand, the development of trains and telegraphs and radio. Both of them affected time quite deeply. And one of the interesting things that happens around 1850 or so, 1860 and 1870, trains radically alter people's experience of time in a number of ways. But one of the best ways to illustrate this is that it used to be that New York, say, and Philadelphia had their own time. You know, their version of noon was different from Philadelphia's version of noon. You know, in 1790, it didn't matter because it took a day and a half to get from Philadelphia to New York. But by 1890, it does matter because now trains are getting you there in 3 hours. So you may now suddenly want to leave New York on the, you know, the 12:05 and get into Philadelphia at the 3:05 and be ready for a 3:30 appointment. And if those two towns have different measures of noon, you know, if they're off by 5 or 10 minutes, everything falls apart. So people started to needed to think about now, right? The idea of simultaneity. Now, Albert Einstein comes along, right, with his radical ideas, and those radical ideas were essentially about simultaneity. And where did these develop? Partially, they developed when he was working at the patent office in Switzerland. His assignment was to work on patents for electromechanical devices that could determine simultaneity. Hmm. And so there is a beautiful example of the overlap. Einstein develops this new theory of the universe, which allows the Big Bang to exist. But Einstein, some of his thinking, some of his deepest thinking was influenced by the patents he was working on for developing new machines that his culture needed. So there is a very nice example of how the cultural questions and the cosmological questions braid together in a way that is really inseparable. And that is, I would argue, exactly what is happening today as we develop these new digital technologies and how at the same time they stress the cultural conceptions of time and are pushing us to develop new ones.
Adam Frank is an astrophysicist at the University of Rochester. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his book, About Time. And it's about time for us to say goodbye, for today at least. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Raman Tungekar produced today's show with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. And as always, thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.